More to Quitting Drinking Than Quitting Drinking by Dr. Paul O. Read by Father Tom W. This audiobook is copyright 1997 by Inner Light Productions. Proceeds from the sale of these tapes help support recovery programs. Copies are available from our toll-free number 1-800-537-6767. We encourage you to tell your friends about these tapes, but we appreciate your not making copies of them. Thank you. And now, here's Dr. Paul.
Hello, hello. My name is Paul, and I'm an alcoholic, and I've used a few prescription drugs and narcotics. My wife and I have been married for 58 years, and we've been emotionally involved with each other to varying degrees of intensity for over 75 years. One day at a time, I haven't had a drink or a mind-affecting drug in over 30 years. That's the longest I have ever gone without a drink. I love sobriety. I love AA. I love the AA way of life. And I've written a book about what it's been like and what I've learned since getting sober. The book has chapters on physical, mental, emotional, interpersonal, and spiritual sobriety. Now, to make it even better, my friend Father Tom, an experienced speaker, lecturer, and teacher, has graciously agreed to read the book for this talking version. The book is dedicated to anyone who finds anything personally useful in it, and to my spouse, Max, who for years seemed to drive me to drink, and who now plays an even more important role in my recovery. And now, without further delay, here's Tom.
There's more to quitting drinking than quitting drinking. Recovery can't take place without abstinence. But abstinence alone is not recovery. Chapter 1. Physical Sobriety. Drinking. Is alcoholism really a disease? In 1956, the American Medical Association declared alcoholism a disease. Not everyone agrees with that opinion. Some agree alcoholism is a disease, but then act as if it were a psychiatric symptom or a personality disorder. Physicians are no better in this regard than the rest of the population, although pleased when they make an early diagnosis of diseases such as cancer, diabetes, or high blood pressure. They often delay the label alcoholic until the patient's whole neighborhood knows the diagnosis. All my life, people have been telling me alcoholics are weak-willed. I grew up in a neighborhood drugstore during the Great Depression. Hobos from the brickyard on the other side of the railroad track would come in to buy Sterno canned heat because of its wood alcohol content. My father refused to sell it to them. He called them drunken bums and said they strained the Sterno through bread in an effort to remove the poisonous effects of the wood alcohol. In his opinion, they drank instead of facing up to their problems like real men should. In pharmacy school, medical school, and all my years of medical practice and continuing medical education, alcoholism was always presented as a psychiatric problem. The recommended treatment never changed. Give sedatives to the mild case and refer the rest to the psychiatrists, even though psychiatrists don't like to treat alcoholics because of the poor recovery rate. Recently, I heard a recovering alcoholic psychiatrist tell his story at my AA home group. He stressed in minute detail how he, in his opinion, drank because of his psychiatric problems. He related that he had received many years of psychotherapy, plus extensive psychoanalysis for these problems, but he continued to drink. As he continued to talk, I wondered, if alcoholism is a symptom of a psychiatric problem, why do psychiatrists become alcoholics? Why do psychiatrists have to come to AA? Why can't psychiatrists teach alcoholics how not to drink, or how to drink in moderation? Controlled drinking doesn't work for alcoholics. Neither does abstinence. That's alcoholism. Alcoholics can't drink, and they can't not drink. While they can drink sensibly on occasion, they can't do so consistently. And while they can abstain from drinking for a time, they can't do so persistently and comfortably. Many diseases such as heart attacks, strokes, and epilepsy are easily recognized as diseases by their spectacular symptoms. Others run their course without displaying such drama. Lung cancer, for instance, begins as a silent microscopic speck in a person's lung and remains hidden until the day an X-ray examination reveals a small, ill-defined, gray, cloudy area of only questionable importance. Eventually, the patient ends up in the mortuary. At what point did the speck become what we think of as a disease? And at what point in its development does alcoholism become a disease? And if alcoholism isn't a disease, what kills alcoholics? A weak will? A bad habit? Stupidity? I choose to believe alcoholism begins as far back as a disease possibly can, at conception. Alcoholism hides in the alcoholic's genes and manifests itself as an abnormal reaction to alcohol. I believe alcoholics drink to relieve completely unrecognized early withdrawal symptoms. Relief from these symptoms makes them feel especially good when they drink. Habitual cigarette smokers get a similar effect when they light up. Both are yielding to their addiction without realizing what they are doing. I don't agree with those outside and inside AA who claim alcoholics drink merely to feel good. That's an unrealistic oversimplification. I refuse to believe we do all the harm we do to ourselves and to others simply to feel good, simply for the fun of it. Far too much of our drinking isn't fun. Quite the contrary. One of the most exciting concepts during my medical career has been the realization that alcoholism is not merely a symptom of a psychiatric problem, it is a distinct disease in its own right. Indeed, in my experience, alcoholism shows little response to the usual psychiatric methods and practically none to Freudian psychoanalysis and other approaches that seek to find out why the patient drinks. Why do alcoholics drink? In the beginning, we alcoholics may start drinking for pleasure or for social reasons or for any of the countless other reasons people in our culture drink alcohol. But how do we explain our inability to learn from the trouble caused by our drinking? Do we continue to drink long after we've had enough simply because we're having so much fun? Why can't we stop? Why is alcohol so important to us? Are we to believe we are so stupid and selfish as to give up the house, car, kids, spouse, job, health, life itself, just for the fun of it? That's ridiculous. There simply has to be more to our disease than that. In the early years of my working as a physician in the field of chemical dependency, a group of excited patients came to me to settle an argument. One of the group insisted that a perfectly normal, well-adjusted, emotionally mature individual could become an alcoholic if he or she drank. The rest of the group wanted me to tell him he was wrong. Instead, I agreed with him. I believe anyone who has the appropriate genetic makeup can become an alcoholic if adequately exposed to alcohol. Alcoholism occurs in all sorts of people, including even those who, until alcoholism develops, have no serious emotional problems. No class of individuals, financial, social, educational, intellectual, cultural, or otherwise, is immune to alcoholism. The only requirement for alcoholism is an abnormal reaction to alcohol. This abnormality develops either early or late in the alcoholic's drinking career. In our culture, non-alcoholics drink alcohol for all sorts of reasons. as a social lubricant, because of peer pressure, or to participate in a wedding, funeral, or party. Others drink to quench their thirst, to relax, to sleep, to relieve pain, to gain weight, to find false courage, or for no particular reason at all. Alcoholics drink for all the same reasons, plus one additional reason, more important than all the others combined. The disease, alcoholism, makes them drink. In truth, it matters little why alcoholics drink or even how much they drink. It's what alcohol does to them that matters. Alcoholics react differently to alcohol than do social drinkers. Furthermore, they are totally unaware of this difference. Indeed, they commonly see alcohol as the answer rather than the cause of their problems. This abnormal effect of alcohol on alcoholics eventually makes them, even if they weren't already, neurotic, confused, insecure, frightened, even insane. In the end, this so-called alcoholic personality is thought to have caused the disease, whereas it has in fact resulted from it. When a person describes himself or herself by saying, "I was an alcoholic long before I took the first drink," I understand them to mean that in their opinion they were emotionally disturbed before they started drinking. Alcoholism is an abnormal reaction, an undesirable side effect, an allergy, if you will, to the drug alcohol. The chemical alcohol reacts abnormally with the chemicals called the neurotransmitters of the brain in such a way as to create a demand for alcohol. In time, this develops into recognizable craving and addiction. This chemical change occurs at such a deep level that the alcoholic doesn't realize it has taken place. This inability of alcoholics to see that they react differently to alcohol than do social drinkers is called denial. However, the alcoholic is not lying. In spite of outward appearances, alcoholics do not realize their relationship with alcohol is abnormal. Ask alcoholics why they drink, and they'll give you reasons ranging from plausible to ridiculous. Only rarely do they realize they drink because they must. Alcoholics really need alcohol. They don't merely want it. For many years, scientists thought of the brain as a giant supercomputer run by electricity. Now they realize it is also a factory manufacturing complex chemicals which determine, among other things, our thinking, our attitudes, our desires, our sanity, indeed our lives, and who we are. Freud, in perhaps his only observation of any significance directly related to the field of alcoholism, allegedly said the day will come when we will realize that every thought is a chemical reaction. It is generally agreed that alcoholics constitute approximately 10% of the drinking population. Why they react to alcohol differently than the rest of the population is unknown, but heredity plays an important role. The degree of susceptibility varies considerably. Some react abnormally by getting drunk and experiencing a blackout during their first drinking episode. Others drink for many years before suffering obvious adverse reactions. Regarding this unusual reaction of alcoholics to alcohol, the Big Book, the name Alcoholics, have lovingly given Alcoholics Anonymous the basic text of AA, says, quote, "We who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from life. We are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. We know that while the alcoholic keeps away from drink, he reacts much like other men. We are equally positive that once he takes any alcohol whatever into his system, something happens, both in the bodily and mental sense, which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. There are types entirely normal in every respect, except in the effect alcohol has upon them. They are often able, intelligent, friendly people. All these, and many others, have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. This phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy. At the time the book Alcoholics Anonymous was written, little or nothing was known about the chemistry of the brain. Also, the book wasn't written by men of medicine. If it weren't for these two facts, I suspect the big book would have stated that alcoholism is an abnormal reaction to alcohol, or an undesirable side effect of alcohol, rather than an allergy to it. Had this happened, alcoholism would more commonly be recognized today as just one of many hundreds of examples of diseases caused by an undesirable side effect of a medication. All medications have undesirable side effects. Alcohol is a liquid tranquilizer. From the medical standpoint, there is nothing unusual about claiming that alcohol addiction results from an undesirable reaction to the drug alcohol. All prescription medications have undesirable side effects. Since alcohol affects mainly the brain, abnormal reactions to it show up there predominantly. Once we get into recovery, most of us recognize our need to exercise caution when dealing with doctors who want to give us mind-affecting medications. But we give little thought to the risks involved in using other prescription drugs. In truth, not until after a medication has been taken can a physician tell whether or not a patient is going to show an unusual reaction to it, and if so, which of the many possible reactions it will be. Prescription medications, while making patients well, can also make them ill, and can do so either while the drugs are being administered or after they have been stopped. They can also cause more serious illnesses than the one for which they were prescribed. They can do this with or without having had a beneficial effect on the original disease. Any number of examples can be offered to illustrate this point. Linda G. discovered the dangers of routine medications the hard way. Her case was reported in the medical literature in 1977. She was an attractive, vivacious TV and movie actress until she developed a mysterious illness, which began with fatigability and progressed through many complications over a period of 12 years. Her hair changed color several times, then fell out. She lost weight and developed agonizing abdominal pains and severe generalized itching. Eventually, one arm and then both legs became paralyzed. Although Linda underwent 340 X-ray examinations and consulted a total of 22 California physicians, none could tell her what was wrong. Many insisted she was neurotic and would have to learn to live with her condition. This made her angry. She decided to find the answer herself. Because of her paralysis, friends had to carry her into the medical library, where she spent many hours taking notes with her unparalyzed left hand. Eventually, Linda proved she was suffering from chronic lead poisoning. The source of the lead was a bone meal preparation prescribed 12 years earlier by the first of the 22 doctors. She recalled phoning this physician early in her illness, saying she wasn't feeling better and being told, quote, double the dose, end quote. The same inappropriate advice sometimes given tremulous patients trying to discontinue tranquilizers. Jack M. is an asthmatic. In contrast to Linda, he discovered that a disease caused by a medication may not appear until years later. For a long time, Jack was happily having his asthma controlled by cortisone. Now he's unhappy about the extremely painful way his bones crumble. His spine collapses abruptly, one vertebra at a time. He grows progressively shorter. He now looks up at people formerly shorter than he. Jack and Linda are but two examples of persons taking a medication in all innocence, only to discover later that it has had a disastrous effect on their lives. Isn't this the same thing that happens to approximately 10% of the people who drink alcohol? Richard T. discovered that some medications stopped abruptly cause diseases that are worse than the one under treatment. When he developed chest pains, his doctor diagnosed angina and prescribed an appropriate medication and warned him not to stop it until told to do so. His chest discomfort subsided completely. When the prescription ran out, he felt so good he forgot to have it refilled immediately, thus stopping the medication abruptly. 3 days later, instead of having angina, he had a massive heart attack and died. In a similar manner, abruptly stopping a tranquilizer after prolonged use can result in even more severe nervous symptoms than those for which the medication was prescribed in the first place. Indeed, convulsions may occur. As we all know, the abrupt cessation of alcohol after a prolonged period of heavy drinking can result in these same symptoms, the so-called shakes, whiskey fits, or DTs. Furthermore, medications can cause the conditions for which they are prescribed. Sleeping pills cause insomnia. Pain pills cause pain. Pep pills cause fatigue. And alcohol and other tranquilizers cause nervousness. The above are just a few of many thousands of possible examples of how prescription medications cause undesirable side effects. Is it any wonder, then, that alcohol, a no longer prescribed medication, also shows undesirable side effects in many people? Should we refuse all prescription medications? Of course not. Physicians and pharmacists constantly watch for undesirable drug reactions, and the United States Food and Drug Administration doesn't permit the sale of a medication unless its potential benefits, in their opinion, outweigh the potential risks. In this regard, alcohol, if discovered today, would not be approved for medical use. By reacting adversely with the neurochemicals of the brain in genetically susceptible individuals, it causes monstrous problems in approximately 10% of the people who drink it, much too high a risk for only questionable medical benefits. What about illegal drugs? Here the risks, including the risk of addiction, surpass any conceivable medical value. While the Food and Drug Administration considers them too dangerous for physicians to prescribe, drug dealers dispense them with no concern regarding their safety. Is it any wonder we get into trouble by using them? Basic assumptions regarding alcoholism. No one knows the cause of alcoholism. That being the case, I am free to believe whatever I want. I don't even need others to agree with me. So, based on both my professional and personal experience, I choose to believe the following. There's more to the disease, alcoholism, than a bad habit or a stupid way of responding to life's problems. Physical symptoms referable to the liver and other organs of the body are caused by excessive drinking. However, excessive drinking is a symptom, not the cause of alcoholism. Alcoholism is a distinct disease. It results from a change in the chemistry of the brain, brought on in susceptible individuals by alcohol or related chemicals. This chemical change accounts for the insanity of the alcoholic's drinking and explains why common sense psychotherapy and tranquilizers don't correct the problem. It also explains why alcoholics return to drinking for ridiculous reasons, or no reason at all, and why they are as likely to drink when things are going well as when things are going badly. It also explains why alcoholics can never safely return to drinking even after years of psychiatric or medical care or recovery in AA. The basic problem is apparently one of bad genes, not bad habits. The same sort of chemical change in the brain probably explains why ex-smokers return to chain smoking after one cigarette. Compulsive overeaters can't stop once they start, and the first drink gets an alcoholic drunk. Psychiatrists commonly use an approach similar to that of practicing alcoholics, in that they administer mood and mind-affecting chemicals to control the feelings and thinking. In non-alcoholic patients who react to these drugs normally, this approach can be effective. But in alcoholics who react differently, it can be disastrous. The psychiatric problems seen in alcoholics are more often the result than the cause of alcoholism. If a so-called alcoholic personality emerges, it does so after the disease has developed. If this were not so, it would be possible by psychological testing to prevent alcoholism by identifying and treating pre-alcoholics. And NASA would not have sent to the moon a man who later developed alcoholism. Once alcoholics start solving their living problems by turning to alcohol, they cease growing emotionally. As a result, if they didn't have emotional problems before they started drinking, they develop them once alcohol begins to exert its covert and peculiar effects on them. Why alcoholics return to drinking. There is a riddle about alcoholism that has never been explained. Since alcoholics can't control how much they drink once they start, why do they start? I like to speculate that the answer lies hidden in the geography of the brain, the specific areas where each brain function is located. Knowledge of brain topography is basic for brain surgeons. Without it, they could not cut into the brain without causing more harm than benefit. There is, for example, a center for speech, a center for the emotions, and an area where memories are stored. Separate centers control our ability to see, to breathe, and to move. Scientists have identified many such areas, and they discover new ones all the time. I visualize the brain as containing three such centers that are closely interconnected: an addiction center, a spiritual center, and a center for the emotions. These centers are highly dependent upon each other. High levels of activity in the spiritual center suppress activity in the addiction center. These same high levels of spiritual energy stimulate the center for the emotions and increase the output of positive emotions while decreasing the output of negative emotions. In alcoholics, activity in the addiction center means an increasing need for a drink. However, the addiction center does not have a direct connection to the thinking part of the brain. As a result, it cannot effectively communicate its need for a drink. Instead, the energy in the addiction center spreads to the nearby center for the emotions. This center then tells the brain something is wrong. Because the message arrives from the center for the emotions, the brain interprets it as an emotional problem rather than an addiction problem. As a result, the alcoholic thinks his or her spouse, job, or circumstance made him or her drink. Thinking is extremely important in this flow of energy. We can, by our thinking, exercise more control over our spiritual center than over our emotional center. Alcoholics can, for example, overcome fear more effectively by deciding to trust God than by deciding not to be afraid. I like the way this theory of three interdependent centers harmonizes with the AA program. The AA way of life energizes both the spiritual center and the center for the emotions. These then suppress the addiction center. As a result, the alcoholic finds it surprisingly easy to stay sober. As the big book puts it, what we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. The theory explains other things as well. As mentioned before, the addiction center can't communicate directly with the mind. It sends its message by way of the center for the emotions. Because the message arrives via this route, it is not possible for the alcoholic or for anyone else to know whether the alcoholic is drinking for emotional reasons or because of pressure from the addiction center. This uncertainty is the so-called invisible line which separates social drinking from alcoholism. In addiction, the theory provides an explanation of much of the insanity of alcoholism, particularly the insanity of the first drink. My theory of the three brain centers also explains why simply quitting drinking doesn't cure alcoholism. On the contrary, the addiction center becomes active in the absence of alcohol. Perhaps someday a means will be found to quiet the addiction center. Until then, alcoholics will continue to suppress its activity by stimulating the spiritual center. Progressing in sobriety. In summary, alcoholism is a disease, a medical problem. Alcoholics can't consistently stop drinking after the first drink and can't persistently keep from starting. To varying degrees, they have literally lost the power of choice as to whether or not they will drink and how much they will drink. Permanent changes took place in the chemistry of their brain when they added alcohol to their genetic susceptibility. Neither they nor alcohol are unique in this matter. All drugs and all medications produce unusual responses in a certain percentage of people. The physical discomfort associated with alcoholism disappears when the alcoholic quits drinking. The thinking problems and the emotional discomfort, both that which preceded the drinking and that which developed as a result of the unrecognized, unusual response to alcohol, persist for a considerably longer period of time. Until these are dealt with properly, long-term, comfortable sobriety is impossible. Thus far, we have discussed only the drinking part of alcoholism. The thinking part is almost equally important and is the subject of the next chapter. Chapter 2, Mental Sobriety, Thinking. The thinking part of alcoholism. When I first came to AA, few things bothered me more than the way people kept talking about drinking. That's all they talked about. I wanted to talk about problems. They wanted to talk about drinking. Today I see it their way. They were comparing their behavior while drinking to the behavior of society in general, but at that time my thinking kept me from hearing what they were saying, so I kept on drinking. I couldn't stop drinking until I first stopped thinking. I finally gave up my way of thinking about life and its problems, and without waiting to evaluate their recommendations, I took the actions suggested by my sponsor and by those who got sober before me. This is surrender. Without it, alcoholics can't recover. In sobriety, although alcoholics return to thinking, they can't return to their old ways of thinking. If they do, they end up like the alcoholic described in the Big Book. Having just finished lunch in a restaurant, the man said, quote, suddenly the thought crossed my mind that if I were to put an ounce of whiskey in my milk, it couldn't hurt me on a full stomach, end quote. Within a short period of time, he was, of course, drunk. Such self-destructive, weird, and circuitous thinking is common in alcoholics. An alcoholic living in a recovery home once told me he'd spent the day looking for a job. I needed the money, he said. He traveled by bicycle because he'd lost his car. The recovery home was on top of a hill, and the day was hot and sunny. When he became tired and sweaty, he thought of a cold beer. I'd have stopped and bought one, he said, but I had no money. Some years ago, I treated a totally surrendered Skid Row alcoholic at Long Beach General Hospital. In the detox unit, after 15 years of hard drinking, he was entirely willing to do anything suggested in order to get well. However, a mere 6 days later, he stood in the hallway smoking cigarettes and swapping tales with two of his peers as several of us passed him on our way to the auditorium. I called out, "Come on, Bill, it's time for the AA meeting." Without the slightest pause, he bellowed, "Hell, I don't need that crap." He had already desurrendered. He had returned to relying on his alcoholic brain to keep him sober, the same brain that kept him drunk. Alcoholics can't survive without thinking, and they can't survive if they continue their old ways of thinking. My alcoholic brain. Thinking has always been a problem for me. If my only problem had been drinking, I could have handled it easily. If drinking is a problem, don't drink. I knew that. But my common sense and good intentions dissolved when drinking and thinking joined forces against me. My brain and my body have always been in conflict. My mind has always wanted things my body can't provide. They never agreed on whether or not we could drink. My body told my brain, alcohol gives us high blood pressure, diabetes, a peptic ulcer, and colitis. It sickens our liver and unpredictably switches our mind off and on for variable periods of time. It causes mental confusion amounting to a toxic psychosis. We almost always walk and talk funny when we drink. We simply do not handle alcohol well. After a moment or two of thoughtful consideration, my brain responded with, oh, well, what the hell? One little drink never hurt anybody. It's not that I was weak-willed. It's just that my mind had a mind of its own. And it changed its mind. Not having a drink was no longer important. In addition, my mind habitually lied to me. One little drink was all it ever wanted. But soon after it got the first drink, it began to chant, just one more. Alcohol didn't quench my mind's thirst. It increased it. As a result, over and over again, I found myself drinking more than I should have, even at times when I hadn't intended to drink at all. Further evidence of alcoholic thinking appears in the affirmative answers when the word thinking is substituted for drinking in the 20 questions published by Johns Hopkins Hospital. Are you an alcoholic? 1. Do you lose time from work due to your thinking? 2. Is your thinking making your home life unhappy? 3. Do you think because you are shy with other people? 4. Is your thinking affecting your reputation? 5. Have you ever felt remorse after thinking? 6. Have you gotten into financial difficulty as a result of thinking? 7. Do you turn to lower companions or to an inferior environment when thinking? 8. Does your thinking make you careless of your family's welfare? 9. Has your ambition decreased since thinking? 10. Do you crave a think at a definite time daily? 11. Do you want to think the next morning? 12. Does thinking cause you to have difficulty in sleeping? 13. Has your efficiency decreased since thinking? 14. Is thinking jeopardizing your job or business? 15. Do you think to escape from worries or trouble? 16. Do you think alone? 17. Have you ever had a complete loss of memory as a result of thinking? 18. Has your physician ever treated you for thinking? 19. Do you think to build up your self-confidence? 20. Have you ever been to a hospital or institution on account of your thinking? After listing these questions in their usual form using drinking instead of thinking, Johns Hopkins Hospital says, if you have answered yes to any one of these questions, there is a definite warning that you may be an alcoholic. If you have answered yes to any two, the chances are that you are an alcoholic. If you have answered yes to three or more, you are definitely an alcoholic. How's your thinking? When I was drinking and my body complained about the bad effects alcohol had on us, my mind would agree. You're right, it would say. This is definitely not good for us. We're going to knock it off forever. However, since we're already drinking today, it's no use quitting now. We'll quit tomorrow, first thing in the morning. Having definitely established the exact date and time for quitting, we were now free to go on drinking tonight, especially since these would be the last drinks we would ever have. Today, I use that same thinking process to stay sober. I tell myself, this is an important day for me. This is the day I don't drink. I drank many a yesterday. And I'm going to drink tomorrow, but I don't drink today. I'd probably not be able to keep from drinking today if I didn't know I was going to drink tomorrow. When tomorrow gets here, I'll check the time. If it's today, I won't drink today. We are responsible for our thoughts. In Change Your Voice, Change Your Life, Morton Cooper points out how, as children, we learn to speak, and seldom thereafter question the effectiveness or even the pleasantness of our voice. Some of us, he points out, speak too loudly, some too softly, some too fast, and some too slowly. One person's pitch is too high. Another starts talking before his partner has finished speaking. Still others appear speechless. Until recovery, I paid little more attention to my thinking than to my voice. I have no idea when I first learned to think, but having learned, I turned my mind loose to roam around aimlessly like an adolescent looking for trouble. I didn't realize the important role my thinking played in determining both the quality and the course of my life. Neither did I understand my responsibility regarding its behavior. I assumed everyone's mind ran on automatic pilot. I had choices, but didn't know it. Indeed, until I learned I had a choice, I didn't really have a choice. Today, I accept the concept that while I am not responsible for all the ideas that fly into my head, I am responsible for those I entertain there. Like a powerful searchlight or laser beam, thinking should be aimed with care. Eye surgeons use laser beams in short bursts to destroy unwanted blood vessels in the retina of the eye. Because of its power, the beam could drill a hole through both the patient and the operating table. Extreme care must be exercised in aiming the gun and fingering the trigger. Thinking is equally as powerful and as dangerous, but not as accurately controllable.
This is the end of side one. Stop the tape now, turn it over, and begin listening.